Yo, 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 what's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of the Sons of History podcast. I'm Dustin Bass, and Alan Joaquim is not with me. I know a lot of you people are going to be very disappointed. I myself am relatively delighted. Don't tell Alan I said that, though. He is on his way back home. He's on a long trip. We can now say that because by the time this airs, he will already be home and there will be no chance of somebody walking into his house without him knowing it. Anyways, that was his great fear. Whatever. God bless you, Alan. I hope that you had a wonderful trip. I know that you did. If you haven't yet, ladies and gentlemen, do us a favor, subscribe wherever you're listening to us, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify, Stitcher, Google, whatever, wherever you are. If it comes with the opportunity of leaving us a rating or a review, could you do that? Could you do us a huge favor and leave us a rating and a review, preferably 5 stars, no less than 5 stars? That would really help us. Also, let your friends and family and neighbors, school teachers, principals, co-workers, let them know about the show. Spread it around. Ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't yet, John Wick 4 is absolutely amazing. Watch that 2 weekends ago, opening weekend, a lot of fun. If you've not watched the John Wick movies and you're a big fan of either Keanu Reeves or really cool action flicks, watch that series. And boy, did John Wick 4 end on a fabulous note. Even more fabulous, I got retweeted, Sons of History got retweeted by the great Scott Adkins. Yeah, the guy who plays Killa and John Wick 4, which is very cool. Thanks, Scott. Greatly appreciate it. You are awesome. Hey, speaking of films, streaming on Epoch TV, is our World War II documentary. It's our very first full-length, full-fledged documentary. It is called The War Stories of George Khalil. You can go and watch that now. I don't know exactly how much it costs, but you can get on Epic TV and watch it. So do us a favor and do that. Also, I have my JFK Jr. documentary that is out. If you really want to know what happened to JFK Jr. on that fateful night in the summer of 97, I believe, watch that. I do a thorough investigation on all that was transpiring around his life and what he did during that flight, before and during, which will make you scratch your head. Also, I have another personal documentary on American communism. You can watch that and find out exactly how much communist thought ideology has infiltrated America and the things that we do or that we don't even think about is tied to communism or socialism, that we do really just about every day. It's very interesting. And I would say that it's not good. It's gotten out of hand, but all you got to do is watch that, take notes and you'll see what I'm talking about. Newsletter sign up. Hey, we send out a weekly newsletter about whatever is going on at the Sons of History, whatever we're doing. So if you want to, you can sign up, just shoot us an email at, thesonsofhistory@gmail.com. Or you can just DM us on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, and I will add you personally to our newsletter. Lastly, I think that's it. We're going to get right into the show. I don't really have anything great to tell you. Nothing's going on in my life in particular that is worthy of note. Alan has been on a vacation, so that's cool. He'll talk about that whenever he gets back. So I'm going to bring in our guest, Frank Castigliola. He is a Board of Trustees Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Connecticut. He is the former president of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations. He is the recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Philosophical Society, the Norwegian Nobel Institute, the University of Connecticut Humanities Institute, and NATO. Now, he's written a number of books. He's written a ton of articles and different things like that, essays. But his books include The Kennan Diaries, Roosevelt's Lost Alliances, Awkward Dominion, American Political, Economic, and Cultural Relations with Europe, 1919 to 1933, France and the United States, the Cold Alliance since World War II, and his latest, the one that I read here recently and did a review for the Epoch Times, Kennan, A Life Between Worlds. And last but not least, he raises his grass-fed beef in Storrs, Connecticut. Not in stores like a place, but a location, Storrs. So without further ado, we've got Frank Castiglione on the line. I am honored, privileged, and super excited to talk to him about Kennan, George F. Kennan, containment policy, all that jazz, Soviet Union, America, all it's going to be a fun conversation. So without further ado, George is on the line. I take that back. Frank is on the line. George is dead, but we're going to be talking about George. So Frank, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. It's good to be on. It's an honor to be on.
Well, I'm glad you think so. And I will tell you this, it is an honor to have you on the show to discuss this fantastic figure, George Kennan. What a life he led. Your book, Kennan, A Life Between Worlds, I loved it. It is rich with just so much information about not just his life, but American foreign policy that played such a pivotal role in pretty much all of the half of the 20th century, the last half of the 20th century. And we're going to get to that, the long telegram and the X article and everything. But first, I want people to know a little bit about you. I read that you ended up dropping out of school after the fifth grade,
my parents did.
Oh, your parents did.
My parents did. I had much more boring life. I went on to sixth grade. Let's put it that way. I went on to sixth grade. My parents did. They're both poor Italian immigrants, and they had to drop out to make money.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I must have misread that on American Foreign Relations Society. But you ended up getting your PhD at Cornell. That is quite a leap from your parents having to drop out of school to make ends meet, and you going on to get your PhD in Cornell. What did you get your PhD in?
American foreign relations history, partly because I was born in 1946. In a way, that's part of the people talked about the good fortune of the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And I was the first year of the baby boomers. I think it's not a coincidence that whatever we think of them, there are three American presidents, recent presidents, born in 1946. Clinton, second Bush, and Donald Trump. So, it was a good year to be born. Let's put it that way.
It was a great year to be born. The war was over. And so that's always a plus. And speaking of 1946, isn't that the year that George Kennan wrote the long telegram?
That's right. February 22nd is Washington's birthday. And that's part of the story. Washington's birthday in 1946.
So, give us a bit of a rundown about George Kennan, who he was, and let's jump right into as well as the long telegram and what that was.
Okay, so Kennan wrote this long telegram in February 46 from Moscow. Kennan, I have to say one thing about the capsule understanding of George Kennan. He's a man of enormous talent, just fantastic writer, brilliant thinker, talented in all kinds of ways. But the only thing greater than his talent was his ambition. And that played a role in the writing of this telegram, because he was stuck, as he saw it, in far off Moscow. He'd not been invited to the Yalta Conference, the summit conference that FDR held with Stalin and Churchill a year earlier. He'd been left parked in Moscow, resentful of that. And Kennan was anxious to make his mark. He was anxious to get out of Moscow, where he'd been for a while, and to make his mark in Washington. And so when people in the State Department asked George Kennan to interpret Stalin's kind of highly ideological speech of February 9th, 1946, Kennan said, all right, as he put it in his memoir, Now I'm going to let them have it. So he laid out, he dictated. He was actually sick in bed. And that was part of the reason for the impetus. He was feeling lousy. Dictated this long telegram, almost 6,000 word telegram, the longest telegram ever sent to the Department of State, in which he laid out reasons why the United States should pivot from trying to get along with the Soviet Union to containing, or limiting, or ending, blocking the expansion of the Soviet Union, which had occurred at the end of World War II as the Soviet armies pushed back the Germans.
So he was in Moscow. Your book makes very clear that he had a love for Russia that almost and possibly rivaled his love for his own country of America. At one point, you note or that you call him the always the Russian nationalist. But he also, while he was working with William Bullitt, who was the first ambassador to the Soviet Union from America, he also witnessed the Stalin purges. So did he have more of a love-hate relationship with now Soviet Russia? And how did that relationship, his relationship with the country, influence his policy ideas? Like you said, now I'm going to let them have it.
Right. Okay. So as you can see, I think probably some of your listeners are thinking, what? What's this guy? He's the author of the containment doctrine of the Cold War, and he loved Russia. How does that add up? Well, it adds up to a complicated person, right? A complicated, complex person. What he loved was the people of Russia, the culture, tradition, especially traditional culture of Russia, the literature and so forth. And he regarded the Soviet government, that was part of Russia, but it was a part of Russia that he hated, partly because of the purges, Stalin's bloody, you know, really in some respects, insane purges of Communist Party officials, Red Army generals and other officers in the late 1930s, which destroyed a number of Kennan's friends, as well as, you know, other people in the Russian establishment. So seeing that up close, because he was reporting on these purges and viewing them during the day, viewing the melodramatic show trials of these figures, viewing them during the day and then writing reports to Washington at night, that really imbued Kennan with a very strong distaste for the Soviet government. And what he saw at the end of World War II, the expansion of Soviet influence into countries like Hungary and Poland was also an expansion of that Soviet-style secret police state. So that's what he hated. But of course, that he saw that government as having been imposed on the Russian people.
So to an extent, did he... I don't want to say that the long telegram was like vindictive on his part, but when you are witnessing these purges, and like you said, some of these people were friends of his and the other diplomats from various countries, especially America, you are helpless with it. You mention in the book that when they first arrived to Moscow, they were just inundated with parties and goodwill. Stalin, I think, mentioned, like, asked Bullitt, "Hey, what do you want?" You know, and Bullitt was like, "Well, and I'd like our embassy to be in this place and look like this." And he's like, "You'll have it." And so there was such supposed promise there, and then all of a sudden, shortly thereafter, you see this purge, this violent purge, that he was helpless and all of them were helpless to do anything about. Was there a bit of vindictiveness or vengeance?
I think there was to some extent. I should back up a little bit and explain one reason why Stalin was so welcoming and hospitable toward the Americans is that Stalin feared in 1933-34 that the Japanese, who were, of course, advancing into China already, that the Japanese would invade Siberia and take some of that sparsely populated, rich in resources territory away from Russia. So Stalin was afraid of that, and he knew that the United States was also, you know, kind of anti-Japanese, and he hoped for an alliance with the United States. So that's part of Stalin's really, you know, laying out the red carpet for Bullitt and all the other Americans. And then, but then that war scare passed, and it was clear the Japanese were not going to invade Siberia. And also it was clear that Roosevelt was not about to accept an alliance with Soviet Union. So the kind of the reasons for that honeymoon ended. And then one of the top officials of the Soviet Union, Kirov, was assassinated in late December 1934. And Stalin, kind of fearful of who knew who was going to be assassinated next, kind of overreacted, and that launched the purges. And we could go into that, it's complicated, but that's what launched the purges. But to answer your question of whether to what extent the Long Telegram is a kind of a reprisal, to some extent, yeah. I mean, in a way, in a basic kind of a way, because after all, containment is an idea of isolating the Soviet Union, to isolate the Russians, not allow their further expansion. And one thing that Kennan hated about the Soviet police state was that it isolated him from the Russian people, because during the purges and even after, it was a crime for ordinary Russians to associate with foreigners. So that meant that Kennan could no longer go to Russian parties, no longer have Russian friends. And so he was isolated from the Russian people. And I don't want to oversimplify this, but one element in his pushing for isolating, containing the Soviet Union was to get back at them for isolating him.
It's very interesting. But like you said, a very complex figure personally, which you make very clear in your book, which makes it even much more interesting, is that you're getting a bit of the man and how he thought about himself, and then sort of that is reflected upon his views on the world. So he is known for the containment policy, the Long Telegram of 46, and I believe he wrote the X article for Foreign Affairs the following year in 47. Is that correct?
Correct.
So
he was so successful in pushing for containment in those two documents, the Long Telegram and the Mr. X article, that it became, as he put it, an albatross around his neck. As he tried to move beyond that for other policies, other things, you know, even at his, as the book points out, even at his funeral, that's what people remembered. That's what we started off this interview with. I mean, understandably, but, you know, Kennan was interested in much more than just the Long Telegram and Mr. X.
And that's what I want to get to next, is he's known for the containment policy, the X article. So this is 46, 47, but you make mention in 48, as close as 48, he starts to have, I wouldn't go so far as to say a change of heart, but wanting to mess with how America is utilizing its foreign policy against the Soviet Union. But the containment policy was used throughout the rest of the Cold War. But as I say, you argue in the biography that Kennan thought America should move away from that policy after a while and conduct a policy of disengagement. Why did he move away from containment, and what was disengagement?
Okay. I think Kennan saw containment as kind of an if-then proposition. If you contain the Soviets, which again had been expanded into these countries as a result of the Red Army rolling westward and defeating the Germans, right? So, okay, if you stop them there at the point where they were in 1945, if you contain them, then Kennan thought, then the best thing to do, as a diplomat, after all, he's a diplomat, the best thing to do is to engage them then in negotiations to reduce tensions, particularly to reduce tensions with regard to nuclear weapons, which soon became an issue, and also to reduce the possibility of a war breaking out over Germany, which both sides occupied. So again, he saw containment as an if-then proposition. Contain the Russians and then move on to negotiations and disengagement. Disengagement is the name of a kind of an approach that he coined in the 1950s, particularly the late 1950s, the idea of a negotiated mutual withdrawal of American and Russian forces from Germany, where they were confronting each other on the German frontier, which remember was a really hot spot of the Cold War, disengaged from that tank-to-tank, soldier-to-soldier confrontation, so that the Americans and Russians would withdraw from Germany, allow Germany to reunify as a neutral nation, and basically demilitarize, or to a large extent, demilitarize Europe in terms of the superpowers. Kennan wanted to return to a situation where Russia and the United States were largely on their own territory rather than engage in a forward operation face-to-face in the heart of Europe. Because he saw that as dangerous.
Yeah, and with the containment policy, and I want to talk about sort of the expansion. So you have his view of if you can contain them to their 1945 borders, then we can sort of move in some other areas, different directions on how we're dealing with the Soviets. Correct me if I'm wrong. It doesn't seem like the Soviet Union was really interested in retaining those borders. They wanted to continue to expand. But I've always been told that Stalin was more of a national communist and Trotsky was sort of a universal global communist. He wanted it to spread throughout the globe. But under Stalin's regime, the Soviet Union continued to expand. And so it seems to me is like, well, you can say that Stalin was, you know, strictly almost a regionalist or just a nationalist, but that expansion continued. And I would think that the Americans were probably thinking, well, okay, Kennan, you have a point about holding their borders to where they were in 1945, but that's not taking place. So we have to continue this push towards containment with the threat of military confrontation. Does that fit?
Well, I can't. I mean, that's you're presenting it, you know, basically Washington's viewpoint, mm-hmm. which became was a prevailing policy. Okay, Kennan saw it a little differently. Actually, he's and also let me just back up a little bit in terms of what Stalin did or did not do. Stalin was, as you put it, and I agree, a nationalist, a communist, and a nationalist, a Russian nationalist as well as a communist. But he was also conservative in the sense of careful. For instance, you know, the largest single party in France was the Communist Party. The largest single party in Italy was the Communist Party. Stalin, I mean, the record shows, Stalin cautioned the French Communist Party and the Italian Communist Party not to try to take power, to not to be as aggressive or as ambitious as they could have been. Stalin was afraid of rocking the boat. In the Greek Civil War, where Stalin had promised Churchill that he would not intervene, he did not intervene. Tito of Yugoslavia did. I mean, there are other instances where Stalin, let's put it this way, when China was about to become communist, Stalin kind of alienated Mao at first by saying to Mao Zedong, well, don't be too ambitious, don't be too careful. I mean, don't be careful. Don't think about necessarily taking all of China right away. I mean, he was nervous about a reaction from the West, okay? And then also Kennan saw it, if you had disengagement, you might get the Russians out of not just the 1945, where they were in 1945, you might indeed roll them back to the borders, closer to the borders of the Soviet Union. He saw the Soviets as occupying Eastern Europe in part because a prime Russian fear from 1945 to 1990 was that West Germany would seek revenge with the aid of a nuclear-armed America. That was their nightmare. I mean, that's not something that we often think about, but that, again, if you look at the now formerly secret documents of all kinds of Soviet officials, Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, you name it, that the West Germans, whom they were in awe of, especially after what the Germans had done in World War II, would unite with nuclear or use American nuclear weapons and wreak revenge on Russia. So the idea, as Kennan realizing that, believe that if you offered the Russians the possibility of demilitarizing West Germany and East Germany and getting the United States out, no longer occupying West Germany, and the Soviets would no longer occupy Eastern Germany, that would reassure the Russians with regard to this fear of Germany using American strength to get revenge. Anyway, that's what Kennan thought. And there's some evidence that the Russians might have been receptive to this. When Kennan put forth the disengagement argument in a series of radio speeches over the BBC in 1957, Khrushchev, on several occasions after that, mentioned Kennan by name and said, those are good ideas. These are the basis for negotiation. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, but that's exactly what Khrushchev said, and we have a record of his saying that to other Americans. Kennan would make the point. Now, we could come back and say, well, Khrushchev was just saying that. You know, how do we know he would have followed through? But as Kennan would argue, well, we never found out because we never gave it a try. Because when Kennan proposed disengagement in the late 1950s, the foreign policy establishment in the United States, both Republican and Democrat, came down on him like a ton of bricks and were intent on humiliating him publicly. And they did humiliate him publicly by making fun of him. And in fact, Dean Acheson, his former boss of Secretary of State, Dean Acheson compared Kennan to a chattering chimpanzee. And this is in an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, the establishment journal with regard to foreign relations. So the point, Kennan, I think he's right. We'll never fight. We'll never know because we never risked disengaging, because the Cold War was really advantageous in a lot of respects for American policy, because the United States, as a result of the Cold War, had the loyalty of West Germany, the loyalty of Western Europe, the loyalty of Japan, and those were prizes that American leaders feared they would lose if there was a relaxation of tension. Also, the military-industrial complex. So, there are reasons for American leaders and many of the American people to regard the Cold War as not a bad situation.
So let me ask you, do you think that Kennan regretted creating more or less the containment policy? And do you personally think that the containment policy was a success or a failure or a good idea or a bad idea? What are your thoughts on it too?
Those are easy questions. I think that Kennan criticized himself a lot, but he didn't criticize, he often, or most often, did not criticize himself about the big things. So Kennan said the problem with containment was, he said, I envisioned containment as a political and economic policy, not a military-oriented policy. But he said, people misinterpreted my policy, officials misinterpreted my policy, and militarized our approach to the Soviet Union. I think Kennan is wrong here, because Kennan presented in the Mr. X article and in the Long Telegram, he presented the Soviet threat as so much a danger, such an existential threat. No wonder Americans, in reading those documents, thought, okay, we better beef up our military. So I think Kennan, in a way, was deluding himself as the result of his impact. But he was sorry the containment was militarized, but I think he helped set the groundwork for that. And then your question, do I think containment worked? Yeah, I think, and Kennan would also say it worked, but I think Kennan would say, to some extent, maybe he's right, that the Cold War continued for a long time, for 45 years. And during, as part of this 45-year period, there were very dangerous crises, the Berlin crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, others, that could have led to a nuclear war, which is something Kennan worried about. So I think in figuring out whether something was a success or not, whether that policy containment was a success or not, you have to factor in somehow the risk that we ran of a nuclear war. And we could say, well, no one wanted that. But that's happy talk. Accidents happen. Miscalculations happen.
Yeah, and I think to an extent, and you're not really... our audience knows this. You're not going to find me sort of defending the State Department typically on domestic or on foreign policy issues. But it seems to me that the State Department was sort of backed into a corner on a risk reward factor, where it's just like, well, we can make a change, but like you said, like the risk, does the risk outweigh the reward, or does the reward outweigh the risk? And for my money, it seems like they thought the risk far outweighed the reward. And
the risk of making a change.
Right. Yeah. And to an extent, it almost was like, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, this is our policy now. The whole world hasn't been blown up just yet. So let's not make any rash moves. Do you think that was, in a simplified version, the way that the Americans are thinking?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think you stated it very well. But again, Kennan would come back and say, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But, and you said the catastrophe hasn't happened yet, but he would come back and say, but it could. And once it does, you're in a whole different ballgame.
Right. It's one of those things where, you make a choice and something bad hasn't happened yet. But the moment you make a change and something bad takes place, irregardless of the change, or regardless of the change, I hate it when people say irregardless, regardless of the change, something bad happens, well, people will automatically blame, well, you made that change, that's why this happened. It's the causation.
That's right. That's right. And I think also, I mean, I think there's a parallel here with climate change, right? I mean, you know, so far, well, you guys have had more catastrophes than we have, but, you know, it seems that the risks are more than a lot of people want to bear. right. And also, but I think it's also to keep in mind the benefits to the United States of being the leader of the free world. There are all kinds of economic benefits. It's good for American industry, good for American leaders who like to, you know, have the idea of the president as the most powerful person in the world. That's something Americans like to think about, you know, like to, it feels comfortable. We hear that even today. So, you know, in a way, the United States, like the Soviet Union, but the United States in a more informal way had an empire. The free world is kind of an empire, not that we ran it, but it was nations inclined to act as we wanted, to do what we wanted.
Right. We made the rules. Everybody just abided by them.
Right. Not completely, you know, not right. Completely, but generally. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. In a way, and a lot of times I make comparisons to Frankenstein, the Mary Shelley book, or The Creation. To an extent, I almost see Kennan, you know, with the containment policy, this was his foreign policy Frankenstein, where, like you said, the only thing greater than his ability and his brilliance was his ambition. He wanted to be known within the power ranks so much that he, and I don't want to say that that's why he put the containment policy together, but as you point out in your book, he loved the attention, the prestige, and the honor that he received from creating the containment policy, the Long Telegram and the X article, that he benefited greatly from it, but later on, he sort of viewed it as this Frankenstein of his own creation, or the Frankenstein's monster of his own creation, and was like, well, how do I go about dismantling it? And in a way, though, the Frankenstein's monster is now moved into the hands of somebody else, and he's no longer the doctor. He's no longer the one who has power over it. It's now transferred to somebody else.
That's true. That's a very good way of putting it. I'd also say that, look, if George Kennan had never been born, if he had died along with his mother, we still would have had, in effect, the containment doctrine and the Cold War. In other words, Kennan popularized that idea in a very two persuasive documents. He popularized it and personified it. But it would have probably been the case even if we didn't call it containment, because the American policy was moving in that direction anyway in 1946-47. He was the right person at the right time with the right documents.
So I want to move a little bit, well, actually a lot further, sort of in our modern era, actually our today. So this past January, you wrote an article for Foreign Affairs entitled Kennan's Warning in Ukraine. What would Kennan think of the West's current stance with Putin's Russia? And since you are obviously a foreign relations expert, what do you think of our stance?
Well, I'm not sure how your listeners are going to react to this, but Kennan would have seen our stance today as dangerous. He's a traditional person. He's conservative, small c, conservative. And, you know, in traditional diplomacy, big countries make sure they have friendly neighbors. I mean, the United States worked very hard for that. Think of the Monroe Doctrine with regard to Mexico, Central America, Canada, and so forth, that these nations they're not under our control, but they also don't stray too far. I mean, think about how we feel about Cuba 60 years after the end of the Soviet Union, because they defied the United States. Well, Kennan saw the world that way and thought, he was against the eastward expansion of NATO. I mean, he was around for the 1990s, and NATO was expanding to Poland and Hungary and beginning to have ties with Ukraine, not admitting Ukraine, but NATO had military exercises, naval exercises of the Ukraine. Kenneth saw that as dangerous. He said that he thought the Russians would never accept it. So that's not to say the U.S. policy is to just do what the Russians want, but it's, I think Kenneth would say that it's in a way a little naive to think that the United States can, over the long run, we're talking about the long run now, look at Afghanistan, we're there for 20 years and yet what did we accomplish? Over the long run, Kenny would say it's kind of naive to think that the United States can maintain a robust military presence so far from the United States and so close to Russia. I mean, Kenny would say the answer there is some kind of diplomacy. And you need some kind of arrangement to end this war that the Russians could live with and the Ukrainians could live with. Now, I think the reaction to that, a lot of people will say, with justification, well, neither side wants to negotiate. Kennan would respond to that, which he did respond on other occasions. He said, look, what seems like incompatible positions, what seems like divergent positions, you know, X here, Y over there, is only the asking price. Diplomacy is a bargaining process. So you need slow, patient, secret diplomacy. You can't negotiate through the newspapers. So because if you give any concession, then immediately that's your own side says, what'd you give that away for? So slow, patient diplomacy by professional diplomats to try to arrive at some kind of compromise. I mean, and let's face it, this war will end. I mean, God forbid, barring a catastrophe, will end with some kind of compromise. I mean, that's probably what's going to happen. Kennedy would argue that the process of moving toward that compromise is something that should have a greater priority than it seems to be having in U.S. policy.
You mentioned the military-industrial complex, which, you know, we're in our fifth season. We mention the military-industrial complex at least once every season because it is a major concern. It should be a major concern for every American. And, of course, this goes back to Eisenhower's farewell address. Speaking of the military-industrial complex, In your article that you wrote the other day for Foreign Affairs, you call Kennan a prophet ignored. This is the excuse, I think, that is given for ignoring the prophet that was George Kennan, which is the military-industrial complex. And you mentioned the war in Afghanistan, 20 years in Afghanistan. Obviously, we were in Iraq. We had, you know, Korea, Vietnam, and a smattering of other conflicts, Desert Storm. You have these ongoing conflicts that cater to the military-industrial complex, and I think that is the excuse that is given for ignoring the prophet. So I want to mention this. While reading your book, and I did point this out in my review, I noticed Kennan was prescient about foreign relation issues, including the post-Cold War relations, the Balkan Wars, the Russo-Ukrainian tensions, expanding NATO, trying to turn China democratic, and among other things. Why do you think those in power stopped listening to him? And do you agree with what I'm saying, that it's strictly about the military-industrial complex?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think that's a big part of it. I mean, after all this money, when I give Ukraine dollars, we're giving them weapons. And so the U.S. government is paying for mostly U.S. companies to be making weapons. I mean, profits, these obviously is profitable. But I don't think that's the only reason. I go back to the idea that the free world is kind of an informal empire that gives the United States certain prerogatives. You know, the fact that the dollar is the world currency, which is something the Chinese are challenging very recently, actually. The fact that the U.S. is the world currency allows the United States to run balance of payments, balance of trade deficits, which we pay for with dollars, which, you know, figuratively go out into the world and the rest of the world uses to conduct their trade. That allows us to have a credit card that we never, you know, it's always overcharged and we never have to pay it off. And that's a deal. That's a deal, right? The American people benefit from that. So I think there's a number of reasons why the United States, and also, you know, there's an imperial mindset. Leaders like being the United States as the world leader, which, look, my view here is that it's un- in the 21st century, it's unrealistic to think the United States can exercise predominance in right up to the borders of other very powerful countries like China and like Russia. I mean, it's after 19, it's, in a way, we're still getting moving away from 1945, where the rest of the world was devastated. And it's only natural that the United States is going to have to share power to some extent with other very powerful countries developing their own military. I think it'd be, Kennan saw that, and it'd be wise for American leaders. That's not to say we're going to be isolated. We're never going to be isolated. We're not isolated under George Washington. We trade with other countries. But the United States needs to be careful to think about what it can do and what's worth doing and what's going to benefit the American people. After all, as you said, military-industrial complex. I mean, I live in Connecticut. Therefore, I believe we need to build as many submarines as possible. electric vote. But, yeah. But, you know, our senators do vote for that. But the point is, for the country as a whole, how much are we benefiting from this engagement? Let's put it this way. The people who pay the most cost for this are the soldiers, the people, many of them come from, you know, lower economic strata, people of color, a lot of them recent immigrants. These are the people who bear the burdens, you know, the people whose lives are, people suffer from IEDs and, you know, and so forth. So I think that's something we need. It's not the people in power. They don't send their sons and daughters to war. There's some exceptions, okay? There are exceptions, but by and large, they don't.
Yeah, it's the old Creedence Clearwater Revival song, where he's talking about it's not the senator's son that goes to war. Do you? Because you mentioned, you know, the military-industrial complex. Other countries not really investing as much as maybe they could or that they should in their own military to build up. Do you think America right now is in or has been for a while under a containment policy of no longer the Soviet Union, but the world? And I say this because you think of the 20th century with World War I and World War II, you had massive military buildups with, obviously, Britain, they own the seas, Germany with their buildup, and obviously France was a big player. You had these buildups, and when that took place, you had this tension because they were so close together, and war ends up breaking out, and not just little skirmishes. Obviously, World War I, World War II. Do you think American policy is to the extent thinking, well, if we have the biggest guns, to say it that way, if we have the largest military, if we're the most powerful, we can control everything and make sure things don't get out of hand to the point where they did twice last century. Do you think it's a sort of a global containment policy?
I think so. I think that's a good way to put it again. But also, in a way, it's patting ourselves on the back a little bit too much. I mean, think about this, China, we tend to regard China as belligerent, militant, you know, building up those islands in the South China Sea and so forth, criticize them and so forth. But they did broker that peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Now, I think some American officials are not too happy about that because they don't want to see China doing the intermediary. But there are people in Saudi Arabia and Iran, and particularly the poor people in Yemen, where they're waging a civil war, supported both Saudi Arabia and Iran supported opposing sides in that civil war. Yemen, obviously, incredibly poor country, no water, it's a total mess. Who are going to be better off? You know, so I mean, I think the United States should try more to cooperate with other countries, even bigger countries, and to try to preserve. We can't do it all by ourselves, and to think even if we have the biggest military that we can do it all by ourselves is naive. Is naive. I go back here, just if you spare me a minute, go back to Franklin Roosevelt, Roosevelt's idea was not one policeman. I mean, one policeman in the world, it was Adolf Hitler's idea. Roosevelt's idea was you need four policemen to run the world, the United States, Britain, Russia, and China. And that idea, I think, bears some revisiting. That's not to say that the four countries beat up on all the others, but the idea is you try to have to some extent, spheres of influence, to some extent, recognizing the nations want to have friendly neighbors. That's the way the world has worked for millennia.
You know, speaking of, because like I told you, we could end up talking for 24 hours straight, but you made me think of something with the G7. The situation with the G7 is like most of those, I think, if not all of them, are more or less democratic nations.
Right.
The idea with the US, Britain, China, and Russia, that would be sort of like a G4, but they wouldn't all be on the same page to an extent. Do you think that opposition there would be more beneficial because you're getting to quote a phrase, both sides of the aisle?
Yeah, I think, you know, actually Stalin put it to an American reporter in 1947, you know, as the Cold War was heating up. He said, look, we still can get along as we did in World War II. He said that to a reporter. He said, look, you have your system, which is different from ours. So what? You take care of your system, we'll take care of ours. Now, that doesn't say, not to say there's not dirty tricks and so forth, back and forth, but domestic ideology does not have to influence foreign policy. And that's something Kennan believed. Domestic ideology, you know, democratic capitalism in our case and so forth, does not have to influence to a large extent your foreign policy. Because if you do, if you're trying to promote democracy all around the world, then, you know, it gets messy. It gets messy because what's democracy mean to Iraq? In Iraq, what does it mean in Afghanistan? And look, we could look at ourselves and say, what kind of model of democracy do we offer? I mean, we had, you know, whatever, you know, the partisanship in this country is out of hand. So what I'm saying here is, I think the number one interest of U.S. foreign policy, I think, is to protect the American people. Number one, protect the American people, the actual people, and two, to try to preserve peace in the world.
I 100% agree with what you're saying, that democracy is often oversold to the point where when you say, well, what does Iran think of that, or Afghanistan, or places like that? It's like they see in the instituting of democracy as a collapse of their current ruling system. In very much the same way as, you know, what we did in, you know, the end of the 18th century, were, you know, pushing out the monarchy. Obviously that was, you know, a bit of a democratic system because they had the parliament. Of course, we didn't really at the end sort of benefit with the taxation stuff, but I think the overselling of democracy as the end all be all, like this is the best way to do it, is, I wouldn't say it's unfounded, but that's a tough argument or a tough debate to win, especially when you're dealing with other countries.
Right. And as Kennan actually spoke to this, he said, look, what we should do should be is a model and have is try to perfect our system as best we can. And if other countries, it's a shining city on the hill. Okay. The shining city on the hill. You don't come down from the hill and try to impose it on everybody else. So, you know, look to yourself. I think that was something he believed in, and it's a lot of other people believe in too. It's we certainly have enough problems here at home.
Yeah. Yes, we do. My last question, Frank, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I loved this conversation. I've got maybe about 107 more questions to ask you, but I'm going to ask you just one more. We mentioned the Ukraine-Russia war going on right now. You said you think it will probably come down to some type of compromise. Hopefully so. What do you think will be the end? And I encourage people to read your foreign affairs article that you wrote in January, because it is a very enlightening, it's a good to give people a good understanding of like the contradictions there of having an independent Ukraine with Russia and everything like that. I just want people to read that. But what do you think the end of this war is going to look like?
I don't know. I mean, if I did, I'd be Washington, you know. I don't know. I mean, I could say that one of the things I'm worried about is that the longer this war goes on, I think we should be thinking about this. The longer this war goes on, the more the crazies, the real crazies in Russia are come to the fore. You think about the kind of really like fascist type groups like the Wagner Group and so forth, we're gaining more credence, more power, the more the longer the war goes on. I think also, I mean, if you just tell me for a minute, there was a New York Times story the other day about the Finland's joining NATO, okay? Finland joined NATO formally. And there's a New York Times story about it. And they quoted General Admiral Stavridis, who's, I'm not sure I pronounced his name correctly, but Stavridis, the former NATO commander. And he made the point in talking about Finland's joining NATO that now Russia has an 800-mile border, an additional 800-mile border to defend, the Finnish-Russian border. And he said that's going to make Putin's calculations that much more difficult. Now, that's the story. That's what the quote. But it struck me that, look, there's a border, right? You can go from either side can attack that border. It can be attacked by Russia against Finland, Finland against Russia. But this former NATO commander was assuming that the border would have to be defended by Russia, which meant he was assuming that NATO is more of an offensive than a defensive alliance. That's one thing. Another thing is that the more we press Putin on conventional forces, the more we incentivize Putin to use the nuclear option, which is extreme and will get us into a wholly different ballgame, which is something we don't want to encourage. So to answer your question, you know, beware of a Ukrainian victory could very well lead to a dire situation in Russia in terms of people coming to power that we don't want to see, and Russia, you know, using nuclear weapons. Again, something, Ukraine is not the 51st state. No matter how brave they are, it's not the 51st state.
Very, very good point. I will probably use that as a quote. No, it is not the 51st state, and we've been treating it like it has been. To your point of Finland, and then if Ukraine actually, you know, wins this war and then joins NATO, at the beginning of the war, when it broke out, I was given a speech at a local Rotary Club, and one of the questions I was asked was, what do you think of the Ukraine-Russia war? What do you think Putin's doing and everything like that? And I was given my explanation. I said, you've had this expansion of NATO to the borders of Russia. And I said, it doesn't matter who it is. I said, but when you back a snake into a corner, that snake is only given one option, and that is to strike out. And so I think I said, this is what Putin is doing from my perspective is an inevitable reaction. And I think to your point with Finland, joining NATO, and then if Ukraine, wins this war and if they join NATO, I think it is, you are begging for trouble. And a cynic, which I do try not to be, but a cynic will look at NATO as, well, apparently those who are running NATO were so disappointed that another world war didn't break out because they love the military-industrial complex so much that they are going to create World War III in order to utilize on a massive, massive scale the military-industrial complex. That's the cynic's view that I try not to have, but I think that we are begging for trouble when we continue to expand this NATO.
Right. Let me make one final point. Think about, from the Russian point of view, it's always good to put the shoe on the other foot. Think about if China had a military alliance, let's say with Venezuela, okay? They had a military alliance with Venezuela, and then they're advancing that alliance. They invite Central American countries, Nicaragua, Salvador, and they're interested in joining this military alliance, right? A military alliance with China. And then China starts negotiating with Mexico, and Mexico wants thinking about joining. How does the United States respond? You know the United States is not going to put up with that.
Right. I mean,
and that strikes us as incredibly aggressive, right? But that's how it looks to the Russians.
Putting the shoe on the other foot is so important. And I think that it goes back to what we were saying about democracy being sold so heavily that you have Americans in general thinking, well, NATO's not wrong. We're not wrong because we are selling a product that everybody should buy.
Right. It's like your loyalty to your home team. It's like your loyalty. You don't question, you know, the Houston Astros. Those are your team, right? You don't question it. and democracy as our home team, you know, and that's the way a lot of people interact emotionally act.
Yeah, and it's I make this statement all the time, but it's the path to hell is paved with good intentions.
Right.
And we are paving a very dangerous path by our undying belief in democracy for everyone. And NATO is always right. Russia is always wrong. And I've had my suspicions for a very long time about the constant badgering, belittling, undermining of Russia. And I'm like, look, you cannot like Russia, and that's fine. But when you have power players that are continuing to poke the bear, since Russia is the bear, you know, you continue to poke the bear, you're asking for trouble. And here we are.
How does that benefit the American people?
Right.
I mean, really, how does that benefit the American people?
It doesn't. And I know that there are a lot of people that are so upset about billions and billions of dollars being poured into Ukraine and giving all this weaponry. And I try, as you say, I try to keep one shoe on each foot, and try to understand, like, well, here's, you know, example A, if we don't get involved, and then here's example B, if we get too involved. And it's like, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't type of situation where it's not an easy thing. It's sort of like ending the containment policy all of a sudden. Like, well, what the hell is going to happen next? And who knows? So, Frank, again, I loved this conversation. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the book, Kennan, The Life Between Worlds. Ladies and gentlemen, I encourage you to read this book, get this book wherever books are sold, because you will learn not just about this man's life and how he influenced America's foreign policy, but America's foreign policy in general, especially last half of the 20th century. It's a great read. And Frank, this is a great interview. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope that all of you enjoyed that conversation with Frank Castigliola. As I made mention numerous times, go check out the book, Kennan, A Life Between Worlds. You can buy it. Madison is going nuts over here, so she is ready for the show to be over. And I really don't have anything else to say. So with that, I hope that everybody had a great Easter weekend. And yeah, that's it. Ladies and gentlemen, we will talk to you next week, and Alan will be with us. We got a special guest lined up. He's actually going to be in Paris, which is going to be pretty cool. Not Alan and not me, unfortunately, but our guest will be in Paris. So that's going to be pretty cool. Not that he's going to give us a tour or anything, but it'll be neat that I think it'll be the first time that we interview somebody who is actually in France. I have interviewed somebody who is French. We talked about Alexis de Tocqueville, I think about two seasons ago. And we talked to somebody this season from the Republic of Ireland. We've had some UK people as well. So it's, hey, you know, international. International is what we do here. So ladies and gentlemen, we will talk to you later. Be sure to subscribe. Go check out our documentaries. And all right, see you later.